Good evening. It's always so nice to see you here, and it's always so nice to see you return year after year, and then to have new faces as well. What a wonderful community gathering. Thank you for being here and for your support. And welcome to the second event of the Leon Panetta 2014 Lecture Series. This year, we're examining the lessons of history, and we ask, quote, is the past prologue to the future? 2014 marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, the 75th anniversary of the formal beginning of World War II in 1939, and the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. In each of these historic events, whether positively or negatively, the lives of everyday citizens were significantly impacted. And a United States government that our forefathers envisioned as limited was called upon to make decisions and take action to protect our country and our freedoms. In the process, the role of government has changed dramatically in dealing with economic crisis, national security and defense, health care and education, civil rights, and income inequality. As we look back on these landmark anniversaries and consider the challenges we face today, what have we learned from history? What should be the role of government? What is the appropriate balance between personal responsibility and government intervention? Are our elected officials meeting their responsibilities? If not, what actions need to be taken? And finally, how have these dramatic changes affected the role we all play as participants in our democracy? We'll pose these questions to two of the most experienced and indeed respected legislators of our time. Together, they have almost 50 years of legislative experience at the federal level. They have seen firsthand government's ability to effectively respond to crisis and to come together for the good of the nation. But they've also seen government fail to take action on matters of serious economic and social importance. They have seen Washington at its best, and they have seen Washington at its worst. Our first guest was elected to Congress as a Democrat from Boston in 1980. Known as a superb legislator and a pragmatic politician, for three decades he authored some of the most important legislation in the country's recent history, including the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As chair of the House Financial Services Committee, he helped craft the compromise bill to slow the tide of home mortgage foreclosures in the wake of the subprime mortgage crisis, as well as the subsequent $550 billion rescue plan. He was the chief author of the landmark Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, the sweeping set of regulatory reforms to prevent a recurrence of the financial crisis. And he led the passage of the Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights Act, a measure that passed with strong bipartisan support and was praised by consumer advocates. Leon and I have known Barney since he was first elected to Congress. Please welcome former Congressman Barney Frank. Our second guest is one of our most popular returning speakers and a very wise and witty Republican United States Senator from Wyoming. Once reelected with 78% of the vote, he served in the Senate for three terms and was Assistant Majority Leader for a decade. Even as a strong conservative, he worked across the aisle on major legislation on immigration, fiscal and judicial issues. Leon and he served together on the Iraq Study Group. And in 2010, President Obama selected Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles to co-chair the bipartisan National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. Since the release of the commission's final report in December 2010, he has been an outspoken critic of the failure of the two political parties to work together and agree on measures to reduce the deficit and govern the nation. Please welcome Senator Alan Simpson.
How do you do, Bonnie? It's good to see you.
Moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 17 years ago, the chairman of the Panetta Institute. Formerly as a U.S. representative, as the OMB director, as the White House chief of staff, as the director of the CIA, and as the Secretary of Defense, he is obviously well-versed in the many roles that government can take and the desperate need for leadership and action. Please welcome Secretary Leon E. Panetta.
Thank you very much, and we welcome you to the second in our forums for this lecture series, the Panetta Lecture Series. As Sylvia mentioned, the theme is 100 years since World War I, and is the past prologue to the future. Last session, we talked about the issue of war and peace and how that's changed over these last 100 years. And tonight we're going to focus on the role of government. And let me just, to show the change that's taken place in the role of government, there's just one figure that reflects that change perhaps more than any other. In 1914, federal spending was $2.7 billion. 2014, federal spending is $3.45 trillion. The expansion of government, I think it's fair to say, was pretty much bipartisan throughout that 100 years. Actually, it began with Teddy Roosevelt, a number of reforms he put in place in the workplace, trust busting, national park expansion. It continued with Democrats. President Wilson created the Federal Reserve, Federal Trade Commission. He used what was called the War Industries Board to run World War I. And then, of course, after the Depression, FDR and the New Deal, FDIC, the SEC, Social Security, farm programs, Great Society, Medicare, civil rights. Presidents Reagan and Clinton used to talk about more limited government, but very frankly, that didn't happen. And in response to 9/11, the latest President Bush expanded defense spending, expanded Medicare benefits, and as a result of the recession, worked with Congress to provide almost $787 billion in stimulus, as well as a $700 billion TARP bailout. President Obama obviously provided additional stimulus, plus Obamacare. It was Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations that said that government ought to be limited to three functions: national defense, law and order, and providing some important public goods, such as transportation. So a lot has happened in the last 100 years in terms of the size of government. And I guess first question I would like to ask both of you is, what should be the role of the federal government today? And can we, should we have a more limited government? Barney?
No, I think we have too little government in some ways now. Yes, we want to have a private sector that is vigorous, that uses free market principles to create our wealth. That's very important. But there are some things the private sector is not going to do. Specifically, if you can't make a profit off it, it's not the private sector's job. That doesn't mean they're bad people. And my liberal friends who denigrate people for doing something just to make a profit have a fundamental misunderstanding. It is the ability, the activity by which people make a profit that creates our material wealth. And people make a profit because they are creating things that people want, which is a good thing. But you're not going to make a profit off of putting out fires or providing police services or protecting the country from terrorism. After all, under President Bush, the second President Bush, we not only increased defense spending, we created the Department of Homeland Security and an enormous number of new federal employees. So there are some things only the federal government can do. Another important function, it's the one that I was engaged in, is to provide the rules by which the private sector operates. And Theodore Roosevelt did that because we used to have no large economic enterprises in America. And then by the turn of the 20th century, we did, and they needed to have a national economic regulation. That then led to finance capitalism, so the New Deal had to put in rules for those changes. That in turn led to changes through information technology and increased liquidity in the 80s and 90s, and I believe the reason we had the terrible crash of 2008 and thereafter was that we waited too long as a society to put in new rules. It wasn't that we deregulated, it's that we waited too long to adopt new regulations for the new rules. And that's the government has to set the rules by which responsible private sector activity can take place. And finally, this one's more controversial. I think the book by Thomas Piketty that's now getting out of discussion is relevant. It does seem to me that the unadorned operation of the private sector will produce more social inequality than is healthy, and that is necessary. Inequality is necessary for the private sector. Nobody should talk about getting rid of inequality at all. It helps the system move. But if you get too much inequality, I think you get unfortunate, unfair social results. One of the things, you know, there are some people you may think in this society who have not been very impressive and haven't done very well. But until we find a way to stop these kind of people from having children, I worry about a system. Well, we literally visit the sins of the parents on the children if we punish them in that way and don't try to deal with that. And it's also economically, I think, ineffective. If you reach a point where there is too little purchasing power in the great mass of the people, I believe that slows that down. So those are the three functions of the federal government. And I would say the lesson that I draw from this is that the bigger the private sector gets, then the bigger the government has to be concomitantly. The more you need to work alongside them to deal with the economic effects and to provide this set of rules. I helped create a whole set of rules for regulating derivatives. And I'm rapidly now trying to forget the whole thing because I'm not in that anymore. But we didn't have to have regulation of derivatives before the private sector invented derivatives, financial derivatives. So to some extent, as the private sector grows in its role, then the public sector rules that go along with it must also expand.
Alan?
Well, Erskine and I, in our travels, found out a lot of things. Everybody loved what we were doing, but said, except that one part. Which was usually their little bruise right there, you know, because we hit everybody. But the thing that's about spending is that everybody in the United States is in the game. There isn't anybody you can talk to that isn't in the game. Whether it's the simple things like collecting the garbage or snow removal or whatever, you can quit all that. You don't need those services. Well, people do. But the tough thing about all the pain we've been through in the last couple of years is sequester, the latest, the debt limit, the anguish, the latest budgets of the President, the House, and the Senate, all of them all over the place, is that none of them deal with two-thirds of the American budget. So how are you going to do anything in America if you don't deal with two-thirds of the American budget? And what are those big two-thirds? The solvency of Social Security, healthcare. Forget the nasty phrases about Obamacare and all the rest and all the outlay and so on. It's what do you do with those issues? And people won't touch them. Congress people won't touch them because they're all hot button and you're going to get ripped to bits by the right or the left when you play with these tough ones. But there is the duty of the federal government, and it is defense, and it is, you know, the health and safety of the American people. But I'll tell you one thing, You get into the stuff we were in, and there isn't a single person, either through the tax code or through the benefits they're receiving or something in the tax expenditures, that isn't coming into their pocket from the federal government. And that's tough to handle because people say, government out of my life. My party say, government out of my life, precious right of privacy and the right to be left alone. Well, that sure doesn't work on the social issues, and it sure doesn't work on the fiscal issues either. So there is one area that I love. It's the Postal Service. That is in the Constitution. Through sleet and snow, they will deliver the... Well, I'll tell you, it's $7 billion in a hole every year, and we can't get rid of Saturday delivery because it would be a torture for people who are waiting for a human to come to their door on Saturday. I mean, this is madness. So,
you raised the issue. We're dealing with a fundamental paradox here when we talk about this issue. I mean, this is going to be a debate. There'll be a debate about whether we should limit government more, et cetera, or what government's role should be. But the reality is that people talk about it, but when it comes to their particular benefit, whether it's a subsidy or whether it's a tax break or whether it's a particular benefit that they're receiving, the reality is they don't want to give that up. The perfect example of the paradox was this rancher in Nevada, Cliven Bundy. This guy's complaining about the overreach of the federal government and the harassment of Western ranchers. He also actually thought slavery wasn't too bad. He's grazing his cattle on federal land, hasn't paid his grazing fees since 1993, over 20 years. There's 18,000 grazing permits on 157 million acres. Most of these ranchers, as you know, play by the rules. Why does this guy touch a nerve when he speaks out about the overreach of the federal government when he himself is benefiting from that?
Well, he's into the game of the anti-government. Well, there's a lot of things I could really get deep into it, but I won't. But I asked a guy once about gun control. They were talking, and gun control in Wyoming is how steady you hold your rifle. That is, and so I can't deal. I just honestly say I can't deal with it. I learned to shoot. I was in trouble when I was a kid for shooting mailboxes and all this stuff.
But on Saturday, did you shoot them or the rest of the
week? No, I shot them. But this guy is cheating the government. Now, let me tell you, there are a lot of people in Wyoming and the western states where there's huge amounts of federal land. They don't know what that is in other states. 52% of Wyoming's surface is owned by the federal government and 63% of the mineral estate. Nevada is 85 or 90. But the guys in Wyoming who are leasing land from the Bureau of Land Management, which is what he was doing, have paid their fee every year on their permit, cow-calf operation. And to make this guy a hero, even the Nevada cattleman who said, this isn't a hero, this guy's cheating and he's making the rest of us look bad, and now that he's a racist, ignorant man, and found to be, all the guys are out there with the gun standing by them, you know, have now headed for the sheep shed.
I think there are two explanations for the popularity, which we do hope is waning. First of all, the romance of the cowboy is deeply embedded in American culture. He's the cowboy standing out there on the range. Secondly, you do have this anti-government philosophy. Look, in a healthy democratic capitalist society, you have two major political tendencies. Both recognize that you need a healthy private sector and a healthy public sector, but they differ about where to draw the line. The Republicans, the more conservative, would push the public sector back some. The liberals, the Democrats, would push it forward some. But until recently, the major political players accepted both. Then comes the Tea Party and an extreme view that denies the legitimacy of the public sector. And part of what these people are saying is, well, he's not really cheating the government because the government shouldn't own that land in the first place. It shouldn't be such a thing as public land. But let me say, and I understand what Alan says, is that, yes, it is true. People are all for cutting the government in principle. But there is no thing in the budget that says, in principle, you should cut it out. Everything is specific. And I learned that in 1968, working for the mayor of Boston, people in a particular neighborhood were complaining because they didn't have a swimming pool. And we started building a swimming pool. And then they started to complain because there was blasting and trucks with material coming in and out. And I complained to an old city councilor about how inconsistent people were, because first they insisted that we have this swimming pool, and then they were complaining because we were building a swimming pool. And he looked at me pityingly and said, "Hey, kid, ain't you heard the news? Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And then everybody wants to cut the budget." But I want to suggest, and there isn't fun, but I have, by the way, two things that the federal government and the state and local governments do that I think we could diminish without hurting that many people in America. At the federal level, yes, it is an obligation to defend our national security. It is not either an obligation, nor do I think it is something doable, to go into broken societies with the American military and fix them. I do not think we can militarily, like Shia and Sunni, like each other. I don't think we can militarily end corruption in Afghanistan. I wish we could do some of these things. And one of the things I would do is to say, look, we have the best military in the world, and they are better at doing what a military can do than anybody else. They can stop bad things from happening, but they cannot go into a foreign society and make good things happen. We could substantially reduce military spending by these kind of interventions and save a lot of money. When people who voted for the Iraq War yell at me because I want them to raise the debt limit, my answer is, you put more of that debt on the books than I did. Secondly, we hear it at the state and local level, but also federally, we spend an enormous amount of money sending the police after, prosecuting and imprisoning people who we think make the mistake of taking substances that they shouldn't take. And I would like to try to discourage them, but I believe that this war on drugs, I hear a lot of criticism from the conservatives about the war on poverty. I wish they used the same metrics to measure the war on drugs, which is a far greater disaster. And if we treated this as something to discourage, as a medical problem, between those two, we would save a very large amount of money.
You know, go ahead. Well, Leon and I served on the Iraq study group. There were five Democrats, five Republicans. We worked for a couple of years. We agreed on every word. The past administration accepted five of the things, and since then about 57 of them have been adopted. But the real issue was, one of the witnesses came in, you talk about democracy and around the world and fractured societies. Never forget the guy, you may remember. He came in, he said, "How do you describe Iraq?" He said, "Well, I would describe it as a country or person in a coma for 30 years, and he suddenly wakes up and they say, 'We have something for you. It's called voting and democracy.'" And he's saying, "I'd like food and water." Because they don't know what it is. And boy, we've learned a hard lesson on that.
And along with it is, in 1947, it made a lot of sense for Harry Truman and a Republican Congress, great bipartisan foreign policy after World War II, to go to the defense of much of the rest of the world that was helpless because of World War II. It is no longer remotely sensible for the American taxpayers to be the defense budget of Germany and Japan and France and Italy, et cetera. And it's time to say now, we're not going to do it tomorrow because we'll give you some time, but within a couple of years, these countries ought to have defense capacities. If they're worried about anybody, they're big enough to take care of themselves. We are subsidizing our wealthy allies at great cost to ourselves.
Barney, let me ask you, just again, you know, talking about the role of government, particularly with regards to the economy, where you played a large role as chairman of the Financial Services Committee. At the time, I mean, we went through this great recession, and you were there. I don't think Alan and I weren't in office at that time. It's 2008.
Lucky you.
Yeah, really. 2008, the country experiences this very severe and prolonged economic downturn, massive job losses, housing bubble bursts, 8.4 million jobs are lost. You were in the committee. You had Bernanke testifying. You had Paulson testifying, Secretary Paulson. Did you smell trouble? Did you think that the recession was coming.
We smell trouble, and there's a debate about this. By the way, I think the reason for it is clear. Too little government. What happened was the New Deal put in a good set of rules. You mentioned the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Investment Company Act to deal with mutual funds, et cetera. And that was a good set of rules for governing how the financial system worked. And then money started coming in from outside the banking system, which meant it was unregulated. It came from oil-producing countries, from Asian countries with big export surpluses, and then also information technology came in, computers. So it became possible for an entity to make loans and then sell the loans and package them, and risk and responsibility became dissociated. People could take risks, but somehow pass along to somebody else the responsibility. And we waited too long to adopt rules. And there was a debate, and some people did feel that, yes, we needed some rules, particularly over subprime loans to low-income people. And some of us were trying to regulate those. Alan Greenspan said, no, that was an intrusion in the market. People were worried about those loans, but virtually nobody saw it. The general view was of Greenspan, Bernanke, most of us in Congress, yes, we're going to have a problem with these loans, but no one saw them infecting the whole economy. And I think what happened, frankly, was that this new set of financial instruments, these extremely sophisticated financial instruments empowered by information technology, intertwined the economy far more than we had realized. I mean, in the Great Depression, there were problems, but there were different parts of the world. What we learned in 2008, people were not fully expecting it, was that when there was a problem anywhere, there was a problem everywhere. And so, yes, there was some perception of trouble, but people had not fully understood the power of this transformative set of new economic activities. And then our job in 2009 and 2010 was very belatedly to put some rules in place.
So, Alan, I think we were always taught that in the free market, risk is inherent. If you make smart decisions, you win. If you make dumb decisions, you lose. We provided the $700 billion in TARP money to try to help out these companies that basically made bad decisions. Should the American taxpayer basically, in some ways, eliminate risk from the free market system? Because that's what this did.
No, I don't think in any way. If capitalism, as I understand it in a sick way, is that you can make a wad or lose a wad. The difference that has changed is now you lose a wad and you go to the feds to get made up. Now, that's what's happened to capitalism today. You lose, you take the risk, you make your bucks, you're a success. You lose your bucks and you're trying to get back in the system with some program. We're trying to get it back. Usually an attempt through the government, and there are plenty of things out there. But I thought I had a sign on my desk that said, "He's your uncle, not your dad." But really, it is not the purpose of the federal government to take risk away from people. And when they come, people say, "Let's talk about the privatization of Social Security." Well, hopefully they won't talk about it much more. George Bush talked about it, and they shot him right out of the saddle. But the point is, when I see these people, if I had that money myself, I could have made a hell of a lot more than this dump here. I said, and if you hadn't, what would you do? Well, I don't know. I said, yeah, I do. You'd go to the feds and try to get it. That's just exactly what you'd do. And you just, this purity of thought, it just doesn't work. There is no.
Marty, you were there.
Yeah, I have to get it. What Alan described is what the situation was before 2009. Yes, it is true. And here's what happened. And by the way, you mentioned bipartisanship. This is all bipartisan. Yeah. And people ask me, well, you know, can't parties work together? It was 2008, just before a presidential election, when George Bush sent his top economic advisors to the Democratic majority in Congress, and we worked together with him. First of all, on the TARP, it was $450 billion ultimately put out. All of that was returned to the federal government from the banks. The money, it's about $50 billion that hasn't yet been repaid, went to keep the automobile companies around because of what we thought that would do for the economy. But it is true that at that point the government did step in. We did two things in the legislation. First of all, it is now a felony for any federal official to step in and advance public money to a failing institution and keep it alive. What the Federal Reserve did for AIG is no longer possible. It is true that there may be some institutions who, if they fail and have this huge amount of debt, that would threaten stability. At that point, the Secretary of Treasury and the federal officials step in and take it over. It is dissolved as a private company. It is put into a conservatorship, and any money that has to be paid out to keep it from being having a disastrous impact like Lehman Brothers, the Secretary of the Treasury is mandated under our bill to recover that in assessments from financial institutions that have $50 billion or more in assets. And the other part we do, and I agree, risk and responsibility, sophisticated financial instruments allowed people to separate risk and responsibility. Mm-hmm. You can make a whole bunch of loans to people who couldn't pay them back, sell them, package somebody who bought them, packaged them in a security, sold them to other people, and the people who made the original loans were long since counting their money. That's no longer possible. Basically, we have said to the private sector what we said. You want to take a risk, take a risk. But two things. First of all, you better have you legally have to have the money to pay off in case the risk doesn't work. And secondly, you have to take a large part of the loss. My favorite part of the bill is what we call risk retention. If you buy up a bunch of loans from somebody else and put them in a security and sell them, you should have to take the first 5% of the losses if they don't pay back, because that's that reconnection.
In the Dodd-Frank bill, which obviously has gotten, you know, I mean, it's controversial. It's been part of campaigns. President Obama said it's probably one of the greatest protections for consumers in this country. Others have criticized it for its complexity and red tape. Give me your sense of where we are with Dodd-Frank today.
I think it is doing what we hoped it would do, namely making it much less likely, not impossible, much less likely that we will have the kind of economic crash we had before by the same causes. That is, I believe we have, first of all, as I said, put in place laws, binding laws, that will prevent the federal government from doing what it did with AIG. People should understand, AIG was a very successful insurance company. They made so much money in insurance, which is highly regulated, that they literally didn't know what to do with the money. So they got into the business of selling credit default swaps, which were basically guarantees that packages of bad mortgages would not fail. When the packages of bad mortgages failed and they were called upon to pay off, not only did they not have the money to pay off, they did not know how much they owed. We went to meet with Bernanke in September of 2008, and he said, I just had to advance $85 billion to AIG. We have rescinded that power. Secondly, he came back a week later, and they said, well, we're going to do the TARP, and we need so much for this, so much for that, and $85 billion for AIG. We said, oh, no, you already told us that. Oh, no, he said. That's another $85 billion for AIG. They not only didn't have the money to pay for it, they didn't know how much they owed. So that can't happen. And I believe we have put into place rules that say, take the risk if you want, but you're going to have to stand behind them. So I think we have squeezed out a lot of the irresponsibility. I don't doubt that 20 or 30 years from now, a new set of innovations will come forward, and it will be important to try to deal with them at that time. So I think as of now it is, first of all, the economy is working fine. The financial system is able to function, but it is functioning, I believe, in a much more responsible way.
Well, now, then, too, they blended in the Volcker Rule.
Yes.
That was a key which helped greatly. And the Volcker Rule, in essence, it means bankers will do banking. They will take money and give interest and sell it out, and you bring it in at 3 and peddle it at 6 and go home at 3, and that's banking, and you stay out of this game of trading, and you stay out of these other sophisticated things, and I think that's a very
like people can still do those, but they can't do it
what
with
is the
federally insured money.
Let me ask both of you, what do you think are the chances? I mean, we're in a slow recovery. You know, it seems to be moving forward, but there's a lot of people who are very cautious and very concerned about what's going to happen. The housing market's a little bit bumpy. What do you think is going to happen? Are we facing another bubble out there that could burst, or do you think we're on the right track?
Well, one of the things on our commission, Dick Durbin, I always love it. People now have identified other people by just naming them. So we would say, well, we got 5 Democrat votes and 5 Republican votes, 1 independent. That's 60% of our commission. Well, who voted for it? Well, Dick Durbin voted for it. Dick Durbin, that commie from Illinois? Yes. And Tom Coburn voted for it. Tom Coburn, that Republican Neanderthal from Oklahoma, for God's sake. And that's one of the deep things wrong in America today, is this stereotyping and picking out. But let me tell you, we did get those votes. And we said to people, here it is. We were telling you that we have hit everybody. But Durbin kept asking, where is the tipping point? Now, the deficit is going down, and we couldn't be more thrilled, Erskine and I and all our group. That's terrific. But the debt is continuing. It's because of the aging of the population and the cost of health care. Forget the negative. It's just demographics. It's the reality of life. So where's the tipping point? Well, the money guys on our commission said, we don't know, but there's a name for that when it happens. It's not called run on the banks, which is the layman's term, but it is called the tipping point, and it's when those who have loaned us soon to be $20 trillion at the end of this decade, because it's just going up, we borrow $1.5 billion a day. Every day, this country borrows $1.5 billion. Every buck we spend 16%. We're borrowing. And so the tipping point is when these governments and these people say, you're addicted to debt and you have a dysfunctional government. You've proven that, and we want more money for our money. We still love you. And when that happens, interest rates will go up to historical places, not 2 or 3%, back to 5 or 6. You know, we're spending more on interest today than 5 other agencies of the federal government to run them. And at that point, interest rates will go up, inflation will go up, and the guy that gets screwed is the little guy. What a country.
And I want to respond partly this way. First of all, part of my difference with the Simpson-Bowles Commission was that they did hit everybody, because I am concerned about inequality. And I want to disproportionately hit people with more money. In Social Security, all 3 of us receive Social Security. I favor significantly increasing the taxation that applies to our Social Security. But if we have people living on $1,800 or $2,000 a month as almost all of their income, I would not restrain that. I think that we need to have a little bit more differentiation. Secondly, and I agree on the demographics, and healthcare is going up, although one thing we ought to be clear. One reason healthcare is going up is that qualitatively we are buying healthcare that didn't exist before. So it should be going up, but not at the level that it's been. That is my argument for reducing America's taking on the burden of defending the world. We talk about the debt. The Iraq War, and I'm very proud to say I voted against it, put, what, $1 trillion on the debt? And it will continue because we have this moral obligation to take care of the people who were hurt. And we would be $1 trillion less indebted with all the interest rate that costs. Finally, while I do think it's important to try to reduce the extent to which we add to the debt, I am not worried about people not lending us any more money. It is true, or charging us more. Dysfunctional government. We reached a point where we weren't going to, Moody's or Standard & Poor's or one of those people, the rating agencies, which did the worst job of the financial crisis of anybody. They made stuff up without any question. But they lowered the American debt rating, and the result was that our interest rate went down. Because here's the problem. If you've got a large amount of money, if you are some oil sheikdom or somebody else, and you want to lend your money somewhere, I have a mantra that I use about making decisions, and this is an audience who will understand it. It's drawn from a great 20th century philosopher named Henny Youngman. And it was his two-liner, how's your wife compared to what? That's my principle when I make any government decision. And if you are the United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, or anybody like that, and you want to lend some country your money, you're going to lend it to America. Because as much as they may be worried about us, we are by far the safest place in the world to lend it. So I think the likelihood of them not lending to us is fairly remote. That's no reason not to change. And I get back to my point. I think it is time for us to say to the rest of the world, for all this time since World War II, we have carried a disproportionate share of the burden. I want us to be the strongest nation in the world, without question. Somebody has to be. And when I look at the eligible candidates, and I'll be honest, if Denmark could be the strongest nation in the world, I would be very relaxed. But they aren't in the run, so it's got to be us. But I believe we should be reducing our military expenditure, starting to phase it in, not by cutting back on doing what I think it's fair to say you can't pay less and do what we're now doing. I think it is time for us to have a strategic revision and say we are not as much in charge as we used to be, and if you're worried, you've got to do something for yourself.
It's very important to make a distinction here. I never said anything about them cutting back. They want to loan us money, and they always will. That's what I'm saying. They're going to say you have a dysfunctional government, but we still love you, and we'll just loan you up to the ham hocks. That's what I'm saying.
But they're not raising the interest rate on the
Well, it'll go somebody... up automatically when that injection comes. Well,
let me ask both of you. We all served in the Congress, and both of you have mentioned the dysfunctionality of Washington. Let's just talk a little bit about that. These guys are going back. Congress is convening today for this week with the prospect that they'll do nothing. I've suggested that. They failed to pass unemployment compensation. They are getting unemployment compensation largely in the Congress now. They've essentially given up. Frankly, the president and the Congress, leadership, both sides, have decided that they're not going to take on immigration reform. They're not going to take on long-term deficit reduction. They're not going to deal with energy issues. They're not going to deal with infrastructure issues. They're not going to deal with trade issues. They're not going to deal with education issues. They've essentially said, we're just going to wait for the next election. And the next election is likely to produce even more gridlock. There's a great frustration in terms of what we're seeing, the inability to govern. What's going to change that? What's going to change that?
Well, ballot boxes will change that. We know some nations use bullets, we use ballots, and that's the difference. But add another one. The Keystone Pipeline has been discussed for five solid years. And he's got two very vulnerable U.S. senators up for election in Alaska and Louisiana, and they're crying for him to approve it. And boy, I tell you, he's caught, totally caught. You've got the unions telling him to approve it, and the Enviro saying don't approve it. And it just seems that, and I haven't gotten to know him, but Erskine and I, in taking on this job, realized that we didn't know our client. The only way you can do a negotiation is to know your client. Erskine knew Bill Clinton intimately. I knew George Bush intimately, George the First. I knew Reagan, we all knew. But we're rudderless. We're waiting for the election, and then we'll wait for the next one. And Erskine and I feel that nothing will be done in this country until 2017, not 2015.
The key is the willingness to take risks.
That's
leadership
right.
involves right. risk. You were willing to take risks when it came to immigration reform. When it came to the Simpson-Bowles Commission, Barney, you certainly were willing to take risks in dealing with the issues you had to deal with. There seems to me an unwillingness to take those risks.
I agree, and it's got two levels. First of all, it affects everybody. We live in a much heightened political atmosphere. people on the internet, people listening, there is a heightened level of energy on the part of activists. And the problem is, and this is what interferes with efforts to compromise, the public is now living in, the activist public, in two parallel media universes. The left and the right hear different things. They believe different things. They believe that there are different majorities, and that is a part of the problem. But there's also another very specific political part of the problem, because this deadlock, gridlock, et cetera, it is of very recent origin. I repeat, in 2008, when George Bush sent his top Republican appointees to the Democratic Congress and said, look, I know a presidential election is coming, but would you please do something that's going to be very unpopular to save the economy? We did it. And then when the Democrats had the House and the Senate and the presidency in 2009 and 10, a lot of very big things happened. Some people may like them or not, but the health care bill got passed. Don't Ask, Don't Tell got repealed. We did a financial reform bill. We did important work on equal pay for women and being able to deal with that. Part of the problem is that people are more frightened about risk, but part of it is political. As a result of the anger over the recession and everything else, what I think you've seen is a significant block in the Republican Party that is opposed to the kind of traditional compromising that's gone forward, and that is the Tea Party. And you see it today. John Boehner is clearly willing to do immigration reform, but he has a large part of his party that doesn't want to. And I think the most important thing going on in the country today politically is going on not between the two parties, but within the Republican Party. And it is a question about whether mainstream conservatives, we're not talking about liberal Republicans, that's not a factor these days, we're talking about mainstream conservatives like George Bush Sr., like Alan Simpson was. Well, you're a little too leftist for some of those people.
Answer the question. Yes.
But like Bob Dole, and I'll give you an example. Trey Gowdy, Tea Party congressman, very articulate from South Carolina, told the New York Times that he had just met with the Attorney General, and he agreed with the Attorney General that we should amend the law so that you don't have these excessive sentences for taking drugs, these mandatory sentences that are disproportionate by any means and are very expensive, et cetera. And he said, we agree with the Attorney General, we appreciate his meeting with us, but we won't be able to adopt any legislation because of his position in favor of same-sex marriage. That's dysfunctionality. Obviously, there should be two parties who differ on a bunch of issues, but the differences should not get so embittering that you can't cooperate on issues where you shouldn't have differences. And nobody's perfect, but I believe that the Tea Party influence and by the way, when George W. Bush was president, he passed No Child Left Behind with Ted Kennedy. During George W. Bush, and even in his last 2 years, they said, we cooperated with him. When Leon was in the White House with Bill Clinton, interestingly, people forget, even while the Republican Congress was impeaching Clinton, they were making deals over welfare and the budget. So this dysfunctionality is relatively new, and I believe it is a substantial part of it, not all of it. It's because of the rigid extremism of this one faction, and I am hoping that what we will see, and I think the ballot is where it is. Last point, people don't vote in primaries. Alan and I spoke today.
Well, there's the key. He's hit the nerve right there, because what's happened, and Erskine and I found it, you found it. If you're a Democrat in your district and you suddenly talk about entitlement reform, you're talking about old ladies and kids and ruining them and throwing old ladies off balconies, and you're going to be visited by the AARP and the ACLU. And they're going to say, keep talking like that, buddy, and you'll be out of here in the primary. And over on the right, if you're a Republican and talk about tax or revenue, you'll be visited by Grover Norquist in his white robes and the club and the club for growth, and they'll take you out. Now that's where this country is stuck by these guys in just rigidity. You pay, and then when you get elected, the primaries, you win the primary, you're home free. You can do anything you want. You can tell the government to stuff it. You can sit on your hands. You don't have any worries because you're going to get reelected every time because you became pure and stuck with the base.
We asked we had a group of students, very thoughtful, very intelligent students today, several hundred. We did this same show, and I asked them at one point how many knew the name of their member of the House of Representatives. It was well less than half. These are the unusually self-interested ones. And then I asked them if they knew when the primary was going to be in the state they live in, and I don't think we got 10%. So I look, politicians make a lot of mistakes, and the media can drive me crazy, but the voters are no bargain either.
Okay, we're going to move on to your questions. Before that, I would like to recognize some of the students we just talked about. Before that,
I hope by now they've learned. They've looked it up.
Let me recognize our question review team, the people that are responsible for selecting the questions, and I'd ask you to please hold your applause until I do that. Julie Copeland, who's city editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio, Philip Molnar, who's a reporter for the Monterey Herald, and Valentin Mendoza, who's a reporter for the Salinas, California. If you would give them a hand, thank you. We also do have a group of students that are here tonight, representing some of those who attended the afternoon program. Could I have all of the students please stand, if you could? Great. Thank you very much. If you would just stay standing, these are some of the schools that are represented: CSU Monterey Bay, the Defense Language Institute, Hartnell College, Monterey County Home Charter School, the Monterey High School, Monterey Institute of International Studies, Monterey Peninsula College, Navy Postgraduate School, North Monterey County High School, Pacific Grove High, Santa Clara University, the University of California, Santa Cruz. All of those schools are represented. Thank you for being here. We're really glad to have you. We had a great turnout. Barney was right. Students were terrific in the discussion that we had, and these two were great. The student program is possible because of the generous support of our lecture series sponsors, and Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students from throughout Northern California to be able to participate. So I would ask you to give our sponsors a hand as well. Okay, let's turn to your questions. Alan, what role do you think the Simpson-Bowles Commission had on subsequent budgetary discussion and legislation?
Well, I think everybody talked about it. We delivered it on December 1st of 2010 after working about 8 months, and it was a good, solid group of people. It took us 3 months to establish trust. There's no trust in Washington anymore, even in the parties, intra-party. There's no trust. The trust was the coin of the realm when we were there. That coin is severely tarnished. So after 3 months, we could begin to talk with each other so that somebody wouldn't run out and there'd be a light of a television camera like a giant moth. They'd go out there and blow all the stuff to bits as to what we've been talking about in private. Anyway, we delivered it, and the president walked away from it. He couldn't have touched it, because people say, what happened there? If he would have been torn to bits by his base, because in there is entitlement reform. And if he had voted for it, I think the Republicans, in their passion to get him, would have voted against it unanimously. They would have caucused to vote no. So we visited with everybody. It's out there. It's a 67-page report. It's in English. It uses terms like shared sacrifice, which has not been used in this country since World War II, and it used phrases like going broke. And it describes, we didn't touch SSI. We didn't hurt. We didn't do anything with food stamp. Everybody that brings up some tragic thing we're doing to humans is a lie. We paid careful attention, or we wouldn't have had a vote from Dick Durbin to Tom Coburn and in between. And so there it is, and it will be a template. It's out there. As they continue to do nothing, Disability insurance will be gone in 2 years. DI, zero. Social Security in the year 2033, according to the trustees, or Democrats and Republicans of high repute, in Social Security by doing nothing, in 2033 you're going to waddle up to the window and get a check for 23% less. 10,000 a day are turning, you know, 65. And when I was a freshman, like these young people in college, there were 15 people paying into Social Security and one taking out. Today there are three people paying in and one taking out. Social Security is not a retirement program. It hadn't a damn thing to do with retirement. It was an income supplement to take care of guys digging ditches in the late 30s and give them 43% of the replacement rate of what they were getting when they were digging the ditch. All of the demographics are shot to hell. Raise the retirement age. We said, let's raise it. It's going to be 67 in the year 2027. And we said, as Barney would, raise the wages subject to the tax. That's fine with us. We recommend that. We recommend changing the bend points so it's more progressive and you hit the rich more than you hit the poor. We recommended all sorts of things to make it work. Give the lower 20% 125% of poverty. That costs, but we built that in. Give 80 to 85 a kick of 1% a year on up. And the point is, you can't believe the shriek we got when we said, we'll raise the retirement age to 68 by the year 2050. And the AARP said, how will everybody ever be able to... I tell you, if I didn't learn to make faces, I know he'll get me, but, you know, I mean...
Well, but now I got to say, yeah, I very much agree with you that we should discuss differences civilly. I didn't think that was very civil, but because there was some... legitimate differences, and I agree with much of that. But here's my problem. You say Social Security is not a retirement program, but for a lot of people it is.
I wish
it were different.
I wish it was.
But I wish I could eat more and not gain weight, so I can't just act on my wishes. And the fact is that I agree with much of what you propose, but when we are talking about those people for whom it is 70, 80, up to 100% of their income, and they're living on $2,000 or $2,200 a month, I would not reduce the amount they would get going forward on the cost of living. So I think we should do most of this. But, I mean, that's my problem with shared sacrifice. You know, who is the Frenchman? The law gives the rich and the poor alike the right to sleep under bridges. And you do some of that. But I want to, with regard to Social Security, when you have people for whom it is a very large amount of money, that's why my proposal, and we agree on this, tax away Social Security for people who have other income. But where Social Security is their sole income, it wasn't intended to be that way. And look, we know this is a problem because the private pension system that was supposed to be an alternative has crumbled. We got to do something for people.
Well, it's described as a retirement. I'm just saying that the origin of it was not a retirement, but people have accepted it.
But it's become that way.
I agree with that. But the point is, we were trying to adapt to that.
One of the things that troubles me, and this is not you making this argument, it's other people who say, well, Social Security, it was okay because when Social Security was first put in, people were dead by 67. So it didn't cost so much. You've heard that argument. The answer is, oh, apparently, Franklin Roosevelt was engaged in a great gotcha. Hey, I got this great retirement program, but you'll be dead before it can do you any good. I don't think that's the model we ought to be taking forward. I understand that's not you, but you'll see people say that. Well, you got to cut it because people are living too goddamn long.
Well, it is a curious thing to mention Social Security in society, and the nastiest letters I get are from people over 60. Vicious, vicious, nasty, oh. But I send them a response. And my beautiful wife of 60 years, and Barney knows her, and Leon, and Sylvia, and she said, you're not pressing the button and sending that, are you? It just says, dear sir or madame, you need a pane of glass in your navel so you can see out during the day.
It's funny also,
the form
I don't want to talk about, on the retirement age, and again, you got to differentiate. people are living longer, but people are living longer divided by socioeconomic status. And some people are living longer than other people. And there are people who are still doing physical labor. There are women who started carrying heavy trays of dishes when they were 18.
We built all that into our proposal. Every bit of that is in there. And
no,
the president embraced the chain CPI, your president.
And I think
and mine,
he was wrong.
Yeah, I know, but everybody else thought he was right.
No, not everybody else.
The Democrats,
excuse me.
Everybody else.
If everybody else thought that you were right, how come it's not the law right now?
Because they're scared to death of the AARP, for God's sake.
That's a mistake that you make that's misleading.
That isn't a mistake.
No, it is not the AARP. If there was no 50. AARP, Alan, you have people disagree with you. It's okay to say they're wrong, but don't blame the AARP for conjuring up what would happen.
You're kidding.
By the public.
They ran full-page ads of people
know,
with tears streaming
down
their cheeks.
And I know a lot of constituents, and I had a lot of constituents who never paid much attention to AARP who felt that way on their own. It's like some of the liberals who blame the NRA for our inability to get gun control. It's a convenient way to sort of wish away the voters. But here's my point on this. On the chain CPI, the chain CPI reduces the amount that people will now get in the future to compensate for a cost of living. If you have got someone living on $2,000 a month, I don't want to reduce what they get. I don't know how we can talk about worrying about inequality and then say, but older people who have $2,000 a month and no chance of making any outside income, we're going to reduce what they would otherwise get. So I want to do it by taxing things away, but that's what the chain CPI does. It takes unless, is there a cutoff? At what point below which do people not get the chain
Why
CPI?
Why would your compassionate president ever embrace as a horrid thing?
But, I don't know, but that's not a sensible argument.
Well,
let me take control
because,
of this.
Because he won, I'll tell
it
you
It doesn't
why.
Take anything away.
I don't
it
know
lowers
why.
The cola.
Right.
It
lowers the amount. It lowers the amount someone living on $2,000 a year in downtown Boston would get a couple years from now. And I don't know why the president wants to keep spending billions of dollars a year in Afghanistan. He doesn't always check with me, and I think he's sometimes wrong.
All right. Well, I'll deal
by the
with
way,
him
by
later.
The way, the answer for to the question that was addressed to you is that the Congress.
What was the question?
As to whether anything's been done with Simpson-Mazzoli in effective legislation. The answer is no.
No.
They haven't done any reform.
Time out. We got Leon so rattled that he just asked him what happened to Simpson-Mazzoli, which was the immigration bill we passed 30 years ago.
That's right. We did that.
Yes, we did that.
Barney and I did that.
All right, Barney. Any chance we can return to separation of commercial and investment banking functions?
Well, ask him that. Hell, I'm not going to answer
that. We took a step towards that with the Volcker Rule. Beyond that, I don't think it is necessary to go. That, for people who don't follow it as closely, that separation was embodied in the Glass-Steagall Act that was adopted at the outset of the 30s. And there were some who say, well, we could have avoided the problem. I should tell you, and again, sometimes the argument for authority works, even Elizabeth Warren repudiates that. The new things that caused the crisis were unaffected by Glass-Steagall. Derivatives, making loans. Under Glass-Steagall, there was nothing that would have stopped the bank from making loans to people who shouldn't have paid them back, packaging them in a security, and selling them. Glass-Steagall didn't touch that. We do, in the Volcker Rule, separate out, as Alan said, it gets you back to more serious banking. Beyond that, I don't see that any problem grew out of the fact that some banks were doing both. What the Volcker Rule says is, we want you to do less risky activities because we insure your money through federal deposit insurance. But I don't see Glass-Steagall any further separation with one exception. We do have in the bill the power to regulators to do that institution by institution. They do have the power to say to a particular institution, you are not running yourself well, and we need to slim you down by taking this out of there. The final point about a total separation, you really could be mandating a fire sale. That is, if you made every institution that had both of these divest over the next couple of years, you're talking about lowering the assets because there are not nearly enough borrowers with enough money to take it on.
Barney, there's another question in here that I should ask you at this point. Do you regret your vote to repeal Glass-Steagall in the waning days of the Clinton administration?
No, and I'm glad you asked that. And the reason I don't regret my vote to repeal Glass-Steagall is that I voted against repealing Glass-Steagall. So there was a nice example of... no, I voted against repealing Glass-Steagall. I did not think Glass-Steagall still made sense in its terms, but I voted against repealing it because it did not come up with new regulation. I thought that we should have new regulation. So the answer is I voted not to repeal... I voted against the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
What would both of you think of a performance-based pay scale for Congress members? I don't know. Not quite sure how that would work, but
I don't know. But they put bills in like that all the time so they can get reelected, but they don't care about it. But the best performance is at the ballot box, yeah, and I really believe. Naively, I've been accused of that always in life, public life, but I really believe that when things are going to get worse, when the tipping point comes, I don't know what that will mean. I know that I agree with Durbin. It will not be good. Interest rates will kick up and won't have a thing to do with who did what to who, and inflation will kick up. But at that point, I think that people are going to... When the guy goes down to borrow to send his kid to the community college and he's been borrowing at 2 or 3% and suddenly it's 5 or 6, he's going to say, who did this? On whose watch did this come about? And it's going to be the guy that got up at every town meeting with his constituents and said, I know the problem and we can correct it without touching precious Medicare, precious Medicaid, precious defense, and precious Social Security. And then you want to say to that person, you are telling a terminological inexactitude. Barney would like that. And then just call him a lion SOB. And at that point, they're going to go back and say, you did this and we're going to take you out. Yeah, Democrat or Republican, that will be the solution.
I think the I agree with Alan. It's at the ballot box. You talk about the performance. Well, nobody serves in the House of Representatives who didn't get more votes than anybody else in the last election. And with only occasional exceptions, when somebody dies and there's an appointment, that's true in the Senate. If you went into a hotel and when you parked, the guy took your car and banged it into the wall, and then the guy taking your baggage kicked it and it fell open, and you got to the desk and they didn't have a room for you, and you got to the room and it was dirty, you would say, who runs this place? Who hired these people? Well, you hired the congressman. I didn't. I voted. Look, I voted for one guy for 32 years. That was me. I was pretty satisfied. I wasn't. I said, look, we three had an experience that very few people in this room had. We once voted for someone who we knew was perfect. By the time we ran for re-election, that wasn't true anymore. We knew we had a couple of things. But, I mean, that's part of the problem, but it's what Alan said before. The public allows itself to get bought off its concern for general reform by specific bribes, by people who are with them on this specific thing. And, you know, that's the answer. You want performance. If you say to me, oh, this member of the House or Senate is so bad that his or her salary should only be 30%. What does that say about the people who voted him in? That's where the cause came.
We talked about this earlier, and I just want to raise it again. Money and politics. The recent Supreme Court decision that eliminated any limits with regards to, I guess, PAC contributions, et cetera, and it's going to unleash a lot more money in politics. How big a role is money in politics playing with regards to the kind of gridlock we're seeing?
Well, I'm a master of lost causes, and there was a group called Americans for Campaign Reform, consists of Bill Bradley, Bob Kerry, Warren Rudman, bless him, we all knew him, he was a wonderful guy, and myself, four of us. And we've been talking about federal financing of congressional campaigns, doing it through the states, cost about $1.6 billion, and that's a lot less than the earmarks piles and all the rest of the stuff that go with it. But down to the issue, we have been disemboweled by the previous Supreme Court decision and this latest one, and we're all lawyers, and you respect the law and you respect the court system. That is the worst opinion I can imagine in the history of this country. Because if you think a guy's going to cough up, if you think one of these fine high school guys is going to turn 18 and put $5 to their favorite candidate, and look at this typhoon of a guy who's putting up 10 million or 15 and anonymously, I think this if people thought Congress was corrupt and on the take now, when they're finished with the next, I think Barney said it today, give them a couple more sessions to iron this baby out, and when they see that the guy who laid 50 million, and don't forget the Dems are in this as deep, the Koch brothers may be the evil poster, but George Soros is not St. Francis either. And so they're in it, they're all in it together, and they're going to go elect their guy, and why do you think they're going to do that? For access. You don't do it for patriotism, you do it for access. And I think it's just the worst, it's the worst I've ever seen in all my life of watching the court and being a lawyer. We're all lawyers.
No, I agree with that, and there's a fundamental philosophical issue here. And I keep talking about the private sector and the public sector. The private sector is supposed to be the place where the more money you have, the more influence you have. That's the free market system. You do have inequality there. The person who figures out better what the consumer wants is going to wind up with more money and can produce more of what the consumer wants, and you get a more efficient system. But the political system is supposed to be based on perfect equality, one person, one vote. And what the Supreme Court has done is to tear down that wall so that the inequality principle, whereby the more money you have, the more influence you have, washes over the equality principle, and it dilutes democracy. There isn't any question about it. The only difference I would have with Alan is this: about, I agree that there are some Democrats who are in it as much, but they are in it more in self-defense. This was a partisan thing. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions, it pretty much breaks down, the vote, it correlates to the vote on Bush-Gore and who appointed whom. Democratic versus the Republican appointees. The courts aren't supposed to work that way, but on some issues they do. And the only way out of this depends on the 2016 presidential election. If the person who wins the 2016 presidential election is someone who agrees with these recent court decisions, then it will get baked in. If it's someone who disagrees, there were 5-4 decisions. They are not sufficiently rooted so that there would be a reluctance to overturn them. And if the next president is someone elected in 2016 who disagrees with them and has 8 years, demographics strongly argue that he or she will get the right to replace enough justices. So I wish there were other ways to do it. But that's going to be one of the factors in the 2016 election. What will the Supreme Court justices appointed by that presidential candidate do to this system? Because Alan is right. And by the way, it's not so much that people once in office will be influenced by campaign contributions. You won't have to influence them. You'll own them from the beginning. You can put that kind of money in there. You'll elect your kind of people, and the subsequent stuff won't be important.
You know, the real distortion is that the First Amendment is the only one on the books that was for a person. The First Amendment was for a person. It's the only one that really is for people. And the court, before this decision, in the last one, have now assumed a role of corporate personhood. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as corporate personhood. It's a total distortion of the First Amendment as to free speech.
Let me ask you, as long as you raise the issue, who will be the candidate for the Democrats and who will be the candidate for the Republicans in 2016? Barney?
If Hillary Clinton wants to run for president, and I cannot imagine that she doesn't, then why would you want to have been as involved and not be the president? She will be the Democratic nominee without any serious contest.
Alan?
Republicans?
Well, our, you know, if we have this continual thing with the Tea Party movement and the social issues, let's just get to that, and we can, and let me address that because of my, let's, I think most people agree that abortion is a hideous thing. I can't imagine anything worse, but I practiced law and had a couple of clients who said, if I have another child, I'm going to commit suicide, and they did. I practiced law in real life. I never was in a corporate tower. I did murder, incest, rape, divorce, all of that. And I loved it because you were doing things with human beings. But abortion is a horrible thing, but what in the world? It's a deeply intimate and personal decision, and a tough one beyond anybody's rationale. And I don't think men legislators should even vote on it. Now, and then this issue of gay lesbian issues and gay marriage. I had a cousin who was a World War II hero with a Silver Star and saved people on the battlefields of Europe. I had a lesbian cousin who was a musical teacher, the most beautiful person, inspired more people probably in music and the arts than anybody I knew. And what is that all about? We're all God's children. We're all human beings. Barney, I didn't know when Barney, I used to tell Barney a lot of jokes. And some of them were very bad. And one day he came out. And I called him, I said, Barney, wait a minute, Barney, that one I told you about 2 months ago. He said, Al, did you ever see Torchlight Trilogy? Well, I never had. He said, well, those are the ones we can tell among ourselves. The point is, I've had a happy marriage. What's to prevent him from having a happy marriage, or her, or anybody out there? What is that? What is that? So,
it's, you're avoiding the Republican candidate for president. Well,
okay, but you can't have the guys in there where we could have had four U.S. Senate seats. Mike Castle, you worked with, five. And that woman was into witchcraft, so we have to watch. Then there was the guy who talked about legitimate rape. That was a beautiful thing. And then we could have beat old Harry Reid like a bongo drum. And he found the goofiest opponent, and he supported her
worked
with
hard
his
to get
thought.
Her nominated. Worked hard to help her get nominated.
Yeah, he helped her get, because he knew he could pick her off. So all I'm saying, what I'm watching here, is Rand Paul is suddenly switching to centrist. He's abandoning Cruz and Lee, which is, the, Cruz is the one I said, you know, if your horse drops dead, it's better to get off. but then Scott Walker is out there. They're drilling his teeth now. And Christie is out there. Jeb Bush is out there, apparently, back. But I don't know. I just know that if we will drop the social issues and move on to the biggest issue confronting America, as you've said, and you is the debt. How do we handle this overbearing debt? And it's just continuing if we're just going to. But anyway, I don't know who's out there, but if we have a chance. We have a chance if they'll just put this stuff in the back porch and move with, what do you do with America, its future, its
tough,
economy,
tough,
the job.
It's tough to do in the primaries. That's the problem.
Yeah. That's why I think, as I said, as a Democrat, the wackier the Republican Senate candidate, the better we are, but that's not good for the country. And there literally are five seats now, Colorado, Delaware, Missouri, Indiana, and Nevada, where there were Democratic senators who would almost certainly have lost to more reasonable, not we're not talking liberal Republicans, to mainstream conservative Republicans. And I think the big issue is going to be in 2016, and there were some analogs. 1964 on the Republican side, 1972 on the Democratic side, the true believers won. You got Barry Goldwater in 64, George McGovern in 72. They are the two biggest losers in American presidential history, those two elections. And in consequence, both parties after that went to more centrist, not centrist, but move more to the center. Because here's the thing about the extremes, and it's been reinforced by this parallel media universe. They are convinced that they are the majority. And if you argue with them, you say you're going to lose with this guy. Oh, no, no. Look at all those people who don't vote. The ideological true believers always claim the non-voters as their silent supporters, and they believe that's going to happen. And so, my interesting optimistic scenario is the Republican Party in 2016 cannot cleanse itself of this, loses badly, but as a consequence, then says, okay, we have no option. We have to confront this, and we have to get back to a more traditional Democratic-Republican
kind of opposition. What Clinton did with your Democrat Party when he got going with the Democratic Central.
Yep. But his victory, the seeds for that were set with the McGovern defeat, and then again with the Mondale defeat. That's what I think is likely.
Let me ask this. There is this new book that's out called Capital in the 21st Century, and the conclusion of it is that there's tremendous income inequality in the United States. He compares it actually to the period going back to 1914, that the distribution of wealth is pretty much the same as it was in 1914, with the upper percentage getting most of the income. And the question here is, at the current rate of growing inequality, do you believe that the middle class's survival is at risk? What is the government's role or responsibility in sustaining and encouraging the growth of a middle class?
Well, that's my third function for the public sector. I mean, there's the basic functions that nobody does, like police and fire, that the private sector doesn't do. They're setting the rules. And this book by Thomas Piketty says that there is an inherent tendency in the free market system to exacerbate inequality, because over time, in a normal situation, the return on capital will exceed the return on labor. And if you don't want inequality to continue to grow, and we're talking about too much inequality. No one rational should be talking about getting rid of inequality. It's essential for the economic system to function, and in a reasonable amount, it's desirable. But I think that is an argument. So it's partly through the tax system. Alan and the commission, they talked about going after some of these tax preferences, which disproportionately help the wealthiest people. I believe it is means putting into effect a system for the financing of higher education, so that can be broadly accessed by young people from less affluent, middle class, working class families, so they can go forward. I also believe, if you look at the history of the United States and some other places, but particularly in America, because we didn't have the negative aspects of this, in what helped people make money, that strong labor unions, collective bargaining are important, especially since if we talk about labor unions now, we're not talking about organizing manufacturing where you might have some international competition. I think there is an important role for labor unions in the service area, in the fast food area, in the retail area in general. And I would, if we were to be able to get a reversal of the anti-labor union attitudes and laws that have been in there. Labor unions have been an important transmission belt for people to be into the middle class.
Alan, we've got about two to three minutes. Go ahead.
Well, he's absolutely right when he's mentioning those kind of unions. My father was a union member. He was a member of the United Mine Workers. But you got to do something with the municipal unions.
They're a separate category.
You got to do something with the firemen and the policemen, because they get in there, and I'm telling you, their systems all, and you know, look at Detroit. I mean, I'm not anti-union, but I'll tell you, Service Workers Union, Andy Stern was on our commission. And he said, after a few months, he said, I wish I'd have voted for it. His will be the biggest union in the world, the service workers. But it is the union movement. You can't get rid of collective bargaining. That's the lodestar of unions. You can do other things, but as I say, mine would be to do something with municipal unions. Now, what the hell was the question?
I would accept that.
You also, Alan, you also talked about tax reform.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
The tax reform.
Well, what we found is an extraordinary thing. We got into the tax code and we found 180 plus things called tax expenditures. They went in the 60s. They are spending by any other name. And what are they? Well, home mortgage interest deduction, employer deduction of employee health care, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, life insurance, parking for employees, on and on and on, charitable contributions, municipal bond interest. So you're messing around in big time. So we say, let's get rid of all of them. Just scrub them flat and give people what they've been talking about. Give them that you pay from zero to 70 grand, you pay 8%. 70 grand to 210, you pay 14. Anything over that, you pay 23. Take the corporate rate and 26 from 36 and go to a territorial system where you can bring it back without it getting hit. And as Erskine says, guys in my party said, well, you can't do that. They'll just use it to buy stock and give dividends. And Erskine said, well, what the hell's wrong with that? But I'll tell you one thing. We found only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the tax code. Run that up the poll one more time. Only 20% of the American people use 80% of the stuff in the code, and only 27% itemize. Alan. So that means they don't even know what the hell's in the code.
Ladies and gentlemen, would
Wait
you
a minute,
please thank these two wonderful people for their presentation.